Welcome to the LTAD Network podcast. I'm your host, Rob Anderson, and on this podcast, we seek out the world's best researchers, coaches, support staff, teachers, and athletes to better understand the process of long-term athlete development. Don't forget to get your 7-day free trial to our online platform and 50% off your first month with the code LTADVIP50. That's LTADVIP50 at the LTAD Network Hub website. This podcast episode is sponsored by Statera. Statera is a web-based application that helps youth athletes and their stakeholders estimate training load, track maturation status, monitor readiness, and manage injury. Put together by coaches working with busy youth athletes, Statera helps keep things simple and brings together the most important training information in one place to ensure that effective athlete-centered decisions can be made. No more complicated Excel tutorials and spreadsheets, just upload your athlete's data and their training schedule and start to take control of their training commitments and workload. Make more informed decisions and protect your athlete's well-being, supporting their performance. Statera takes your data very seriously. GDPR compliant and registered with the ICO, choose from a range of maturation indices and validated measures, or customize your own. Statera can record any training variable and all your data is fully exportable. To reach out today and get a free walkthrough, head over to www.statera.uk. That's STATERA.UK. Welcome to the LTAD Network podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Pordy Roche. Pordy is the head academy strength and conditioning coach for Arsenal Football Club. Prior to this, he was the lead under 9 to under 6 coach and was instrumental in the development and implementation of the physical development framework for the academy. Currently, he leads the physical development program for the under 18 and under 23 squads, and works alongside 3 strength and conditioning coaches to implement an industry-leading program. Prior to working at Arsenal, Pordy gained considerable experience in a number of sports, and in 2008 began work for the Irish Rugby Football Union as the Academy Strength and Conditioning Coach for Munster Rugby. During his time at Munster, he held the position of Assistant Strength and Conditioning Coach for the national team and prepared players for the 2011 Six Nations and Rugby World Cup. In his last season with the IRFU, he was awarded the title of Head Strength and Conditioning Coach for the Irish Under-20 squad, who competed in the 2013 Six Nations and Junior World Cup competitions. Pordy holds a master's degree from Edith Cowan University in Perth, as well as accreditations from the National Strength and Conditioning Association of America, the United Kingdom Strength and Conditioning Association, and the Australian Strength and Conditioning Association. He's currently a director on the board for the UKSCA, and in 2015, for his work in youth sport, Pordy was awarded the Strength and Conditioning Coach of the Year for youth sport by the UKSCA.
So, Pordy, welcome to the podcast. Fantastic to have you on today, mate.
Thank you for having me, and thank you to those who are going to listen in.
So, give us the backstory. Let us into the world of Pordy Roche when you're growing up in Ireland. What did it look like as a kid? How did sport come on the horizon? And what did that adventure, how did it take shape? What did it look like?
I suppose I had an amazing childhood and an amazing upbringing, working class, small little town in Tipperary called Care. 3 sisters who really forged who I am today in lots of ways, and 2 parents who worked very hard and, you know, drove that work ethic in me to work for what you want. And so I had a really, really good upbringing family-wise, and we're all still very close, thank God. And I suppose in Care, small little town, but I was surrounded by so many sports, Gaelic games, like Gaelic football, hurling, athletics, soccer or football as we call it here. I played everything growing up, absolutely everything I could. I played for my school, I played for my club, I played for my county. I represented my county and club in both the Gaelic games and in football. I ran 100 meters and through the shot put for County Tipperary at national level. And then it was a kind of around 15, 16. I stopped growing quite young, so I'm a short guy, early developer. I'm only 5 foot, and I kind of stopped. I was always quick and powerful as a kid, as that one of those earlier developers, which I'm sure we get onto later on, and the dangers of that. And suddenly I was being caught for pace and power by other. I was technically good, but yeah, I was never going to be a top player. And I developed shin splints quite young, quite early on, and which turned out to be compartment syndrome. which needed a bit of surgery and a bit of time. And you can look up compartment syndrome in your own time if you want. But it led to me then to, you know, finding other means to stay fit, and done a lot of cycling, mountain biking. My buddies on official trails around Tipperary, which is brilliant. While I was recovering from compartment syndrome, then I went back to the football, Gaelic games, and I just wasn't enjoying it as much. And at the time, a little gym had opened in Kerb, and it was opened by a real, really top end amateur bodybuilder and powerlifter called Bernard O'Brien, who still is a mentor and friend to me, and his wife Deirdre Dwyer. They set up a little gym open to the public, only a couple of hours every night. It was free weights, machine weights. They had a couple of the old original Airdyne bikes, little roar in the corner. You had to be 16 to join. I turned 16, I went down to join. And he really took me under his wing. He saw that I had the genetics for weightlifting. And we really started technique. He was hammering technique until I turned 18. I wasn't really allowed to do any max efforts, to my frustration, because at that stage I probably thought, well, I'm done growing here. Like, so, and it was probably at 17, 18 then I obviously went off to university and studied, went to Cork, and I studied sports and leisure management, recreation and leisure management in Cork Institute of Technology. And I think that's where my real passion for strength and conditioning really came about. So I had that wonderful base of weight training, discipline, technique, really honing on technique from Bernard and Deirdre and Kerr. And then I started really picking up on this in university. There was a wonderful gym there in Cork Institute of Technology. And Munster Rugby at the time were using it as a base. So their Cork branch was using that as a base. And I used to see these big guys coming in, pumping iron every day in the gym when I was up there training before college. And as part of my degree, we were studying aerobics, weight training, circuit training, as well as physiology and management. So it was a real nice mix. I think that was where I had the first real exposure to what strength and conditioning is. And there was a guy called Mark McManus who was lecturing us in college, but he was also the Munster Rugby strength and conditioning coach as well. And he really kind of really exposed me to what strength and conditioning was. And I was straight away, I was bitten by this, because I love training and I love coaching things and really love teaching. And I found myself, even though I was a student in uni, I was coaching my fellow students through our exams. They were coaching me, and I really got a bite for coaching. And it was during uni that actually I got my first job coaching, which was teaching aerobics. when I used to go to an aerobics class on a Wednesday night, because part of our exams involved an aerobics exam for the iTech exercise to music qualification. And I went, I'm not going to fail this, I want to do this properly. So I was probably the only one of two boys in a class of 50 ladies doing aerobics on a Wednesday night. And suddenly a year later, I've been asked to take the class because the girl that was doing it, she was finished. So that was a real first exposure to managing large groups in a very challenging environment. And it was really, really worthwhile. But I suppose from Cork Institute of Technology, then I met my first foray. I found that weightlifting was for me, and I was fascinated by the Olympic lifts and powerlifting, but I had no coach, and I was looking at this going, where can I find? And so one day by chance, a wonderful man called Billy Cable, who's renowned in Irish weightlifting and Cork weightlifting, was coaching two sprinters in the gym I was now working in the university gym part-time. And I was looking at this going, okay, I need to talk to this man. And he coached me for free for many, many months and became my weightlifting coach and taught me Olympic weightlifting. And then I suppose from there, I got into the world of strength and conditioning that way, because all my friends were in weightlifting clubs, powerlifting clubs. And it was a big part of Munster Rugby's strength and power was weightlifting, powerlifting movements. So I suppose through fate would have it, the Munster Rugby strength and conditioning coaches, Mark, and then a guy called Aidan O'Connell, who took over from Mark when Mark changed roles. He kind of said, oh, Paddy knows what he's talking about here with regards to weightlifting. He seems to be good at coaching. We see him in the gym with the students. And so they asked me, would I get involved for the summer program, looking after their long-term athletic development pathway, which is 16s, 17s, 18s, 19s, and 20s. And I've done that for four seasons, part-time summer program, where now I'm a strength and conditioning coach. Now I'm getting exposed to all facets of strength and conditioning. And then that led on to me working part-time in the University of College Cork while still working in CIT. So I was doing a lot of hours, lots of voluntary hours. I worked with the Paralympic Sailing Club in Cork, you know, different set of skills dealing with a special population, learned so much from them. So along the way, I was literally coaching anything I could. Rob, I was in the local rugby club, the local football club, athletics as a volunteer. As I said, I was taking the Paralympic sailing team. And then, long story short, a full-time position came up in the University College Cork. I was the first strength and conditioning coach there, looking after all the sports clubs and the performance gym there. I spent a year there, and then a full-time position came up at Munster, which was very hard to turn down, and I kind of jumped into that again. And this was under the guise of and the guidance of my friend and mentor to this day, a wonderful man, Dr. Liam Hennessy, who I'm sure you all know. And that was my real first exposure to, it's not just lifting weights now and trying to move quickly. Like, look, let's look at functional movement. Let's look at, and even though a big part of my upbringing would have been very functional around Olympic lifting and mobility, stability to get into positions, I was never au fait with how we assessed it, how we looked at it, how do we look at movement. And he taught me a whole new set of skills around the holistic development of an athlete while still developing the qualities they need to be successful in their sport. So I spent five full-time year seasons at Munster. And then and in that time, I was lucky to have my friend now, Des Ryan, and my boss, who's just left Arsenal. He was a coach education officer, manager at Irish Rugby, and he would have visited all the clubs and provinces delivering coach education courses and really nurturing and supporting us as staff on the ground for Irish Rugby, make sure that we had the support we need to deliver the programs we needed across the schools, clubs, and the full-time academy program. Because in Munster, I worked with the full-time academy as well as three schools in the area that had talent-identified players. As well as a broader range of clubs who needed assistance and guidance to spread the net of talent ID and make sure that any boy and girl out there that could play for Munster or Ireland was getting a chance to develop. So then I suppose 2011, I decided to go traveling for 2 years around the world, which brought me to New Zealand for the 2011 World Cup as part of my job, which was fantastic to see the best in the world at what they do. In the best country in the world for rugby. And from there, I moved to Australia for a year where there was another change. I couldn't get a job as a strength and conditioning coach because I only had a temporary visa. You know, it's a hotbed of strength and conditioning, Australia, New Zealand, as we know. And they weren't going to take a chance on probably a guy with a temporary visa when there's so many talented S&C coaches in the country. And I found that very frustrating. And it was a little blow to, oh, I thought we'd settle here for a bit. But actually, ended up personal training in a small gym in Melbourne, and I learned so many other skills there. And what wasn't for me wasn't for me. And then we moved on after a year, travelled Southeast Asia, Malaysia, back to Ireland, and worked for a short time with the Irish under-20s there for the Six Nations and Junior World Cup as the strength and conditioning coach, which was another wonderful experience to see top international youth players and 20s players. And then the job came up at Arsenal, an opportunity came up at Arsenal, and actually I was unsuccessful in the job I went for, but it was the academy manager, Liam Brady at the time, who saw something in how I dealt with the players in my practical interview and said, would I come over for a part-time job? And lo and behold, it became a full-time job and I'm here since. And it was Des opened that door, but Des had to remain impartial in that selection process because he had just started. And you know, rugby people, I was a rugby guy, even though I never played rugby. Rugby people in the football world, it was new. It was, you know, I can't have too many of them, Paddy. It's going to be Liam's decision and the head of football's decision. And it just worked out really well in the end. And I've gone in and immersed myself I came over for a 2-year contract, and this is year 9. So this is where we're at. That's my little journey in a nutshell. A magnificent start as a young athlete that failed. And got into strength and conditioning through injury, through meeting the right people at the right time. And if you're to say who's my mentor, I've got so many, it's hard to even name them. But Liam Hennessy, Des Ryan, Billy Cable, Bernard O'Brien, as well as the, you know, I'm on the UKSCA board at the moment, and the people I speak with there, Sarah Gilroy, Chris Bishop, Andy Boyd, Steve Barrett, Kevin Paxton. I'm surrounded by, you know, Rich Hunwicks. I'm surrounded by all these good people. I've got so many mentors, so I feel very lucky.
Mm. So what is it about working with youth or developing athletes in particular that has kind of grabbed your attention rather than going on to the upper echelons of senior level performance?
That's always something that interests people, because I suppose I only had this conversation with a colleague yesterday that it's deemed to be your elite if you're working at the elite end. When it was actually Des's philosophy was always that the best coaches should be working with the young athletes, bring that skill set to the young athletes. So I've worked at senior level in rugby and in other sports, and I've tasted that. But I felt my influence and my skill set was better development for the development athlete, the youth athlete, because I could see huge amounts of opportunity for teaching, learning, developing, because you have them for a long period of time. You're not going season to season where it is heavily dependent on performance, where you go in and you probably have to, you know, if you don't get them fitter, faster, stronger in a 6-month period, you're in trouble. And then you go on to the next job or the next job. And you keep bouncing around trying to implement, you know, a philosophy while you're getting results quickly. So I think my skill set was very much built around the youth athlete. I felt I had the patience and the knowledge and the ability to take a young athlete from starting their S&C journey right through to the professional phase of their career. And that's why I think that appealed to me the most. I love teaching. I love coaching. I'm not saying you can't do that at the elite end, but definitely the scope for development at the elite end is much tighter. Yes, in an off season in rugby of 10 weeks, you get more strength, speed, power. That's without doubt. But what happens then in season, mid season, when you know you're playing game after game after game? Whereas in youth development, you get that. You see them literally growing every month, whether that's in stature or as people, because as they mature and their body changes, so does their brain, their attitude, their behavior. And I just found that fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Because I think back to when I was a young athlete, if I had that information and guidance, would I have been a better player? Would I have been a professional footballer? Probably not. I wasn't good enough. But would I have pulled out a sport, formal team sport, as quick? Because, you know, I felt I couldn't get any quicker, couldn't I get any faster, or my injuries happened, you know. So that's probably in a nutshell why I work in youth development.
Fantastic. Well, let's dig into the kind of setup at Arsenal. So let's start with a real broad picture. What does it look like in terms of the staff provision across the academy from an S&C, a medical, a nutrition, psychology kind of perspective for the developing athlete?
So currently it's changed quite a bit actually during the lockdown period, obviously with changes in budgets and structures, et cetera. But initially, and it is, I suppose, look at now, currently anyone that doesn't know, the Arsenal Academy is split between two sites. We're fairly unique in that way. I think West Ham, one or two other clubs are similar, that they've got two training sites. So we've got the Walthamstow Hale End Academy, which is where the under-9s, under-16s train. And there you've got three full-time S&C coaches, headed up by Perry Stewart, and you've got two full-time physios and a number of part-time physios and doctors that look after. They've got, I think, about 180 players there. So that's the hotbed of that's an amazing petri dish of activity and chaos. And that's where the work is done early on. And then the London Colney Academy, the London Colney training site, that's where the first team, the under 23s and the under 18s train. And there you've got two full-time S&Cs. I look after the under 18s. My colleague Don May looks after the 23s. And now we've got a guy that works in the middle between the Ian Jones, who does pretty much all the rehab. He's the rehab specialist for the 18s and 23s players. So he's got a great handle on the full-time athletes there. And we've got three full-time physios headed up by Colin Blackburn. Our doc is full-time there, Dr. Jez. And then again, the psychologist who's just left us, Darren, would have been floating between two sites, and our nutritionist floats between the two sites. Tanya Kumar, that's very much a growing role. Psychology is, still quite new, 4 to 5 years in the club and certainly nutrition. So and we've got a sports scientist in the main academy as well with the 18s and 23s, Nav Singh, who's basically our data scientist, who has vast experience working with the first team as well. So, yeah, we're and then that's all headed up by Mr. Tony Strudwick, the renowned practitioner who's come in to replace his Des and his role. And that's where we are at the minute, structure-wise.
So are you guys still, I guess not adhering to, but still following that process you had previously around the arrow of technical competence up to integrated conditioning, or is there a little bit of a change in the kind of philosophy?
We're very much, yeah. Tony's come in 15 weeks ago now. So when Des moved on to back to Ireland full-time with Setanta, what he had built was, you know, this world-leading, I hope to say, renowned department. And Tony's come in now, and the great practitioner that he is and the great manager that he is, he's looked at it and gone, okay, there's a lot going on that's really good here, but, you know, how can we make things better and move things on? And that was Des's mantle. It was always, please move this on, you know, make it better. That's what any good head of department would do. And currently that arrow approach still exists in our mindset, certainly, and in our day-to-day work. And that's always in the background. While Tony develops, you know, I suppose how he wants to take the department next. And certainly that arrow now is really tying in closely with the most efficient movers pillar, which is a pillar of Per Mertesacker's vision for the academy. So it's slightly changed in its naming, and most efficient movers, basically that pillar covers everything to do with football fitness, football coordination, down to, you know, athletic development, growth and maturation. It's all encompassed in that new pillar, which the arrow has fed. And then it's going to be, you know, up to Tony in his tenure here to, you know, develop that most efficient mover pillar off the back of the arrow approach. So it's still very much there in essence, just slightly worded different now, based on, you know, Per's our academy manager. He was there when Des was there, and we were just starting to build that pillar, that new pillar, which the arrow feeds into.
So what does that look like in terms of the provision along each stage? Obviously, having full-time athletes is a different kettle of fish to having, you know, under nines. So what's the kind of contact look like from coaches who are delivering athletic development? What is the like kind of structured to unstructured little games? How does it kind of look if you were to take a look across the spectrum of the academy?
So yeah, we've a lot of contact time with the players. I suppose if we're to start from the youngest to the oldest, the under nines, under 11s, that phase at the moment is very much football based, and let them play ball as much as possible with minimal influence, I suppose, from athletic development, strength and conditioning. It's just formalizing fun games. It's you know, looking at them, how are they moving as they develop and grow, and it's kind of giving them a little taste of what strength and conditioning is with regards to movement competency and fun games. And it's actually Christian Vassallo, who's no longer with us, working with us, who runs his own company now called Trainer. He would have wrote that whole curriculum for the under 9s to 11s, and lovely little curriculum of fun activities, games that encompass all the necessary skills and movements those little boys will need as they get a little bit older. 11-12s is very much then pitch-based competency and running mechanics. They do a lot of work with the coaching staff to make sure that the movements we're performing in our sessions on the pitch are moving into the training practice. So if we're looking at pressing activity in football, we know that requires a lot of change of direction, agility, footwork, body position. So we will incorporate that into our drills as well as carrying out the general movement patterns you would with any warm-up activity. And then from 13s, 14s, 15s, now they're getting really into the formal strength and conditioning program, where they come out on day release from school one day for one full day a week. So we get real extra contact time with them there, where we're looking at their functional movement, we're looking to go to maturation in detail. Now they're getting an individualized mobility stability program while we're drip feeding in the big compound movements that they will need at 15, 16, 18 when they go full-time in the full-time program. The 15, 16s now are a little bit more formal. They will have an individualized gym-based program as well. And, you know, when you say under 15, a 14-year-old has a gym-based program, well, a lot of it might be mobility, stability, technique, or some of it might be load. And remember, the growing body, tendons, ligaments, and muscles need loads to develop. So there might be, you know, plyometrics in there. There might be jumping activities in there. There might be bodyweight exercises. There might be resistance training exercises appropriate for that player. And then 16 now, under 16, we must forget, and we talk about early specialization, Rob, but like at under 16, these boys are being looked at as potential professional players for Arsenal first team. And at the minute, we've got Jack Wilshere in training with us with the under 18s at the moment. He's doing a bit of coaching. And it's brilliant to listen to him because he made his debut in the Premier League at 16. So he had to be ready at 16. So that's the kind of bit of pressure we're under as well. That it is early specialization, whether we agree with it or not. It's how we prepare that talented young boy and develop him, not just to make their debut at 16, 17, but that they can continue to develop as they grow and mature. And then when you come to 18s and 21, 23s, now you're full-time. Now you're 5 to 6 days a week. I would have 3 gym-based sessions a week with the 18s, as well as a prep session every single day before training. I have a speed session, pitch-based, and an agility change direction session once a week. And my colleague Dom would have the same with the 23s. So we've got a full-time contact program there, where everything now is individualized based around their needs and demands, which someone might say, oh, that looks like an elite level program. Actually, the basics are quite basic because my under 18, my average age is 16 and a half, 17. So they're still growing, they're still maturing. Even at under 23s, the average age is 18 and a half, 19. Some of them are skeletally, musculaturally, not fully mature. So it's striking that balance between development and performance, which is really fascinating.
Absolutely. And I mean, one of the things you mentioned a couple of times there is the role of growth and maturation monitoring, etc. So what role does that play? Is that just an observational element, or is that, does that feed into injury prevention? Does that feed into where potentially what groups those individuals are playing with or training with, if they're training with, you know, more biologically advanced or less, if that's appropriate? How does that work?
That for me is, and I'll stand by this, and this isn't research backing this. This is my own anecdotal research. That growth and maturation assessment for us is probably one of the best things that Des, Perry and I have implemented in the academy. So prior to working with the under 18s and 23s, I worked with the under 9s, under 16s, and then Perry Short took that position when I moved to the 18s and 23s. So it was on the ground there that it was actually Noel Carroll, who's now worked with Hinsta. He put in our growth and maturation assessments in there based on the research from Camish Roach and Mirwald and Dr. Sean Cumming and all this great information that's out there. And he built a spreadsheet to assess these players. And then when I moved on to the professional development phase, Perry Stewart took it to another level with Ivan down there, Ivan McCandy, and now Jordan and Charlie, who worked there. They've taken it to another level of looking at the detail. Like, we can all assess this and have a lovely spreadsheet, but what do you do with the information? And Perry's developed this lovely traffic light system, pre, post and peak height velocity. And it just highlights to the coaches, based on their current maturation status, are they red, amber, green? Are they in the danger zone? Are they going through it, or are they out the other side? And it's visual information you bring to the coach and go, listen, Rob is in the middle of his PHV here now. And I'm starting to see it. I'm starting to see aches and pains. I'm starting to see him a bit lethargic. We just need to keep an eye on him and back off on his training loads. So it's not just a tick box exercise to say I think for me, starting out when we got to Arsenal 9 years ago, we had there was a huge amount of growth related injuries because the staffing wasn't there to do this. The staffing, there was only one physio, maybe one fitness coach trying to run everything. So it wasn't fair that they had to try and, you know, pull. You would just pull a player. If a player had aches and pains, you just pull them. And that's detrimental to the boy, because a growing athlete, the worst thing you can do for an athlete who's struggling is pull them from training. You want to keep them training. So that growth to maturation assessment for us really helped us in minimizing and reducing growth-related injuries like Osgood-Schlatter's, Sever's disease. We were getting some PARs in the lower back that we had never seen before, because of the amount of training we're doing, but also every boy trained the same, no matter where they were in the stage of maturation. And that was no one's fault. That might sound very critical of who was there, but it wasn't. They didn't have the staffing or the understanding to do this. So for me, that assessment of growth and maturation has been one of our greatest tools at minimizing and reducing growth-related injuries while maintaining training performance. So when I was there, I might reduce, you know, a boy's going through PHV, he's clearly struggling. Let's increase mobility, stability type activities. Let's reduce load-based activities in the gym or on the pitch. So let's minimize high impact plyometrics or, you know, excessive speed work. we don't stop it, we just minimize it. Their priority is football. Can they continue to play football? And building that relationship with the technical coach, going, okay, you've got a choice here. We, you know, Rob is struggling here. Do I pull him completely for 2 weeks until it settles? Or can we, can he work in this part of the session, which is not as intense as this part of the session? And before you know it, you've got a boy who's not pulled from training. He's training. He's not doing as much, but he's happy. He is sore and uncomfortable, but he's happy. He's still training. He's doing the technical work. The coach is still, he's still engaging with his mates. He's still part of the squad. Because that's the last thing you want to do for a young athlete is pull them completely from what they're there to do. And that's play the sport.
Did you find much resistance from parents or from the athletes around the idea of training around these injuries? If the previous kind of thing was, no, we'll go off feet, you know, that you're football for a month or 2 months. Or if you found they've been quite receptive to that idea of actually, we're going to train as much as we can within these boundaries.
They were mixed bag, really, and still is. I think it's with anything, any conversation you're going to have with a parent has to be very, very careful and very articulately thought out, because if it's good news or bad news you give them, if they've got a severe injury and you have to tell them they're out for this period of time, well, that's heartbreaking for the player and parent. And we're treating these young boys like, you know, they're top professional players as young boys, but they're kids. So you need to treat them like kids. And we mustn't forget that their emotions are at the level of their age. So a lot of what we done early on, because even though it's 9 years ago, S&C in football, athletic development in football, was still quite new and still quite okay. And it was under the guidance of the ECCC guidelines from the Premier League that a lot of these positions were created fairly rapidly. So there was, like, you take it, the day I started 9 years ago, the club would have went from one fitness coach at the academy on two sites, so that's two, to about eight over, and a head of this department in a very short period of time. So a lot of what we do is not to frighten people, but to educate people. And having that conversations, the casual conversation after training with the parent, is more powerful than a formalized meeting where we're sitting around the table. That trust that you're trying to look after little Johnny here. I have to reduce this now, or we'll have to maybe later on, if he doesn't get better, pull him for a month. And that was the biggest, I suppose, the most powerful conversation you could have. Might be in the car park going, he's moving really well, but I'm noticing he's getting a bit sore. What are you seeing? Ask the parents, what are you seeing? How are they feeling? Oh yeah, he's not sleeping, finding that he's coming home from school sore. Well, then you go, okay, well, you're seeing what I'm seeing. This is how we can approach it, one of two ways. And you kind of try and let them make the decision for them. And that took a lot of time, obviously. That takes a skill set of conversations with the parent in an articulate way where you're not giving them bad news. You're giving them news that I need to modify his training here, or he could be out for much longer than he needs to be. And then there's times they get injured. It's a chronic injury and it happens quickly and they are out for a long time. And then that's another conversation. But I think building the trust with the parents is huge, because until they become professional players, the trust, even when they become professional players, the parent is very much their peer and their sounding board. And if you get them involved in the process from day one, I think you get big buy-in. And not to say you don't have difficult conversations. Of course you do. Because not everyone is always happy with what you do. But building that trust with the parent is massive.
And I think, this would be something you've experienced, is those other conversations. So obviously, you know, dealing with kids, they're in school and they're getting pulled into the basketball team if they're half decent, or they're asked to run cross country, all those kind of things. How do you manage those wider conversations when you maybe have a player who has something like Osgood Schladders and you're, you know, trying to reduce load on the one hand, but on the other hand, they're maybe being pulled to go and do something else? Obviously, young athletes don't necessarily have the confidence to say, no, I'm not doing that. So how do you navigate that sort of situation?
I still have no correct answer for that. That still happens. If you're a young, talented boy at Arsenal, your school wants you to play for him, the county wants to play for him. I've had in the past under 18 players who play on Saturday and then play non-league on a Sunday, which they're not meant to do, but they play for their local buddies team, and suddenly the workload is through the roof. The thing is to try and get trust with the parents and players, and we've often asked them to keep a diary of their extracurricular activities. So whether that's accurate or not accurate, I'm sure other people in other clubs and other sports might have better ideas around this. We've tried to track what they do, particularly if they're starting to get that growth-related awkwardness or pains. Then you have to ask the parent, okay, is he playing at school? Is he playing basketball at school? Is he playing football at school? Can we, you know, I'm trying to reduce his load here so that he plays on Sunday for us, so that he's happy and healthy. And can you help reduce that in school? Can you ask the PE teacher or the head teacher to speak to me? I've had a couple of those conversations, and a lot of it is, well, we've got a school cup final Thursday. We're paying him a scholarship. He has to play. So then you can fight that all day long, and you can pull the Arsenal card and be that person where you go, well, he's an Arsenal player. Or you can do what's best for the boy because he's getting that pressure. So then that's a case of sitting with the technical coach at the club at Arsenal and going, okay, this is what I'm hearing. I'm hearing this unofficially. He's getting a scholarship from this school. He has to play. What can we do? So all we can do is control what we can do and reduce his load with us. It might be, listen, play your school game on Friday. You don't train Saturday. You come and play with us Sunday. And if you're feeling okay, you'll play this amount of minutes. But if you're not, we're not going to risk you. And I think once the parents start seeing that, then they start to go, okay, yeah, we need to buy into this. And we've had several incidences where young boys have had external trainers doing extra football on at the weekend, extra running. Oh, in my review, I might say, you know, Johnny's running mechanics need to be improved, and I'm going to work on that in his athletic development sessions. And the parent takes that as Johnny needs to learn how to sprint better, so let's get a sprint coach. And the two nights are not with us. They're now on an athletics track at 14 with painful knees doing sprint mechanics. So that is continuing to happen. It's about educating the parent. And I know that sounds like a really sitting on the fence answer, but there's no real solution to this, only that you can only reduce what you can reduce in your training sessions. And you might think, well, the club are compromising then, when in fact the club, he's going to play for the club. Yeah, but at the minute, he's a young athlete being pulled in 10 directions. And the parent is doing what they think is right. So it really is about education and about knowledge from both sides. And this ties in actually with a conversation I had with a parent of one of my under 18s last week. He wanted to know about this player's program. And I was on for an hour and a half chatting. And he could not believe the level of detail we go into. Because all he heard was from other parents is that, oh, this my boy wasn't getting powerful enough, so now he's doing extra power training. When in fact, it was like, the message is, he is getting powerful. He's doing really well. He's not fully developed yet. I can't just keep loading him here. His priority is to play football. They hear he's middle of the table with his power scores. Now we need to make him more powerful. But once I talked to this parent and I highlighted my pathway for his boy, he was like, okay, this makes a lot of sense. Why don't the rest of the parents know this? And I said, well, they sometimes only hear what they want to hear. So that's our job, is to educate the parents. And the parents educate us as well, because I don't know what the demand for that young boy is all the time. I don't know what his journey from home to school to training back to home is. And a lot of that takes its toll on it. So we need to be sympathetic to the parents also. It's a very much a two-way transparent conversation. But unfortunately, parents and agents have a lot to answer for. They want to accelerate the player's development instead of trusting in the system. So my job and my advice to any parent out there who, you know, wants what's best for their son and daughter is to trust the system. Yeah, you question the system. If you're not happy with the system, you're allowed to ask that question. You can't accelerate development. And that's why it's called long-term athletic development.
Yeah, I think it's on the surface, it seems quite easy, right? You say to a kid, right, you're not playing for school because you're playing for us. And, you know, the kid could stay in front of you and say, yeah, yeah, but, you know, then they go home and they maybe get the social pressure from their mates, or they get the pressure from the PE teacher. And actually, and this is something, you know, I've kind of rubbed up against the last few years, and my stance has probably changed on it a bit, is, you know, looking at it holistically in terms of the biopsychosocial element, like it actually could be really important to that individual that they play in the school cup final with their mates, because maybe it's the last game they're ever going to play with their mates, you know. And okay, they may go on to play at the first team, or maybe they won't, and that would actually be a real treasured memory for them. It's, you know, you might be in the pub when they're 35 years old talking about the goal they scored in the cup final with their pals from school. So there is an element, sometimes we can be very fixated on, look, the ultimate goal is this first team contract, but we can sometimes neglect the fact that, as you said, they're still kids, and they might put an equal amount of value on playing, you know, whatever school it is, their local rivals, as playing the Tottenham game on a Sunday. Like, they, in for them emotionally, it may be an equivalent or potentially even more important if then, you know, their mates' social bonds are really critical to them.
That's a wonderful summary, Rob. They are just kids, and I'm all for holistic development. So it is an early specialization sport. As I said, if they can let us know what they're doing, I'd far more prefer that than to keep training them to follow our plan and our football program, when in fact we're doing damage or we're detrimental to their development because they're sore, they're tired. I would rather prefer, and if the parent could let us know that, yeah, he is playing on Friday. This is his cup final for his school, and he loves playing with his buddies, as you say. Wonderful, wonderful. You know, I don't want to stop that, because unfortunately the stat is in the Premier League, out of the 20 academies in the Cat 1, the Tier 1 academies, I think 0.012% make it to the Premier League. So there's a huge amount of them that fall off. So they're young boys who are kids. They need to develop. And that basketball they're playing in school might have, you know, that might have another pathway for them in their development for football. So as long as we can have these conversations with parents and with the technical staff, and that at Arsenal, like Per Mertesacker has a wonderful philosophy of lifelong learner, and he's all about learning. And, you know, whether that's education, football or other things, he himself is an avid basketball fan. And we actually have a basketball hoop up in the gym where the boys love to throw a ball around. So he's all for that. And it's just understanding where they are and what's important to them right now, if they're 12, 13 and 14. Is it that social aspect? Because we're asking parents to travel 3 nights a week to training and then again on a Sunday. We have some people traveling 2 hours to get to training, missing out on skateboarding with their buddies, missing out on that basketball game in the local community hall their best friend is playing in. So we have to be very careful in this and balance it correctly. And that pressure comes from the fact that it's, unfortunately, it's an elite academy, and, you know, unfortunately and unfortunately, and there's pressure there from a lot of people to produce players. So we need to be very careful of that. Not all of them make it. So we need to create memories that both in the club and without and outside the club.
So we talked a little bit around, you know, measuring growth and maturation and how that can impact some decision-making around training loads or the content of training programs in terms of, you know, reduction of those higher impact elements, of, you know, introduction, maybe more of those mobility stability. Is there a bit of an overlap then into competitive elements in terms of biobanding tournaments or fixtures? What's the use like of that within Arsenal?
Yeah, so very much, again, Perry Stewart would be at the forefront of that with our the youth development academy and the early youth development academy set up. And I know that's his whole area really, is the biobanding. And as a club, you know, we're trying to get involved in more tournaments where biobanding is put in place. You know, I know Southampton, Norwich, Leicester have done a huge amount with Dr. Sean Cumming on this, and we were part of one of those tournaments, and it's still a difficult one. I wholeheartedly believe in it, as an early developer who was not challenged until he was 16, and then it was too late. And then off the back of that, you know, it's still trying to find, there has to be buy-in from the FA and the Premier League that this becomes a formalized league or cup situation across the training and playing year. And that's a bigger conversation, and it's a bigger, because they, you know, Dr. Sean Cumming is involved with the Premier League in a growth and maturation study, and they're looking at all these things. So until that happens, it is going to be individual clubs really trying to talk to the next club and let's have a little tournament. But for now, for me, there needs to be a very much a formal, under nines, under 16s don't play a competitive league. Like, they play every Saturday or every Sunday, but it's not a competitive league. There's no winning, there's no cup at the end of it. They do play tournaments and cups. They do have little, you know, tournaments and cups. The 16s play the Floodlit Cup, the 15s play a Floodlit Cup, which is Thursday night under lights, a wonderful occasion for the under 15s. But they do play competitive fixtures, but not weekly. So let's make that weekly or at half term, instead of going off on a wonderful trip to Dubai, which we used to do lots of tournaments and tours around the world, which is wonderful for their development. Well, how about at Easter now? Let's have a biobanding tournament in Arsenal, and we invite Real Madrid, we invite Juventus, we invite, and let's see, and Tottenham and Chelsea and Everton or Leyton Orient and all these other clubs. And I think that needs to come from the Premier League and the FA, and they certainly are doing a lot of work in that. They just haven't hit the nail on the head yet with regards to making it formalised. But certainly for me, for holistic development and long-term athletic development, it's hugely important. I still see it at under 18. I still see that some boys come in first year full-time and they're physically not ready and they don't play a single minute. And the heartbreak is unheard. And next year, now they're physically catching up. Now they're starting to show themselves a little bit. So we're all guilty of this. How can we affect that then? You know, well, that boy, is he better off playing with the 16s for a bit? Is he better off playing down? But the minute you say playing down, as a parent, or now you're a full-time footballer and you're asked to go back and play with the 16s on a Saturday. So it's a difficult one that we haven't nailed yet, but the club are big on it and big on giving the talented player a chance. So the question we always ask, you know, when recruitment or anyone comes to me and goes, okay, has Rob a chance? I go, okay, well, what's he like technically? Do you think he has a chance technically? What's he like on the ball? Yeah, he reads the game well, he's technically good. Well, this is where I think he could be physically. You make your mind up, because you have to have both now to play in the Premier League. But certainly, what are we doing for the biobanding is hugely important. And again, the more tournaments we have, the more feedback we're going to get from the players as to how successful this is. And I know they're starting it actually in rugby as well, aren't they? So how I'm fascinated to see how that works out, like a early development collision sport. So
yeah, it's definitely something we're working on. And you know, obviously people put forward different systems, like, you know, the weight banding in New Zealand, but if you don't have a population that size playing the game, then all you do is maybe play sevens because you can't get enough players. But yeah, I think it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because people would have no qualms if you said this player is good enough to play up with the under-23s or he's good enough to play first team. But there is that negative connotation when it's the other way. And when really what we're trying to do in both scenarios is say, well, this is the appropriate level of challenge now for that kid. The appropriate level of this challenge is at under-18s, this kid's not being challenged enough, so we'll push him on. Or he's being challenged too much and he's drowning on the pitch and actually he needs to drop down a bit where that, you know, is a more appropriate level of competition. But as you say, there's always the added information that gets put on. Well, that's obviously back going backwards. He's dropped down. That's obviously a negative. That means we've got to work twice as hard, or we've got to, you know, really do something dramatic here to turn the situation around. When really what we're trying to do is say, here's the appropriate level of challenge.
And that all comes back to managing expectation with the parents. And you've hit the nail on the head there. For me, in my experience, it is managing expectation. Your boy is talented. And this is, sorry, I'm sidetracking here because this is a very interesting conversation. The whole biobanning will start and end with the guidelines from Premier League or FA. At the moment, under EPP guidelines, each boy is, any boy that's available to play between under 9 and 16 is entitled to play the same amount of minutes every week. So 50-50 pretty much, you know, to develop and encourage participation and make sure every boy is getting game minutes, which is fantastic. But then when they come to 18, and we do try and manage this expectations with parents prior to them coming up full time, we do go, your boy may not play next year. One, because of large amounts of players in the squad. Two, because we feel if he's physically not ready, we're protecting him. He's a technically good player, but actually he's exposed every Saturday he goes out on the pitch and it's on TV. It's now the under 18 games are streamed live. You got scouts, agents, other people looking, and this boy we know is a really good player, but he's getting exposed physically. So it's having that transparency with the parent. And if you can have that conversation, that's fantastic. And I actually had it, when you talk about playing up and playing down, I had it with that parent that I spoke about the athletic development program from. But this parent seemed to be really informed. And his boy is under 18. He's been playing quite a bit with the 23s. Now he's back with the 18s because of positions. There's a couple of boys come back from injury who are older and need game time. And there was an under-17s game recently. And he said to me, the boy said to me, do you think I can play the under-17s game? I'm going, of course you can. He's eligible to play. That's actually his age group. And he ended up playing in a month. He's played three levels, 17s, 18s and 23s. He's played men's football in the Papa John National League Trophy to the under-17 London Cup. And there's a boy who understands, and his parents understands, okay, he just wants to play football, whatever level it's at. And that's really refreshing, but not always easy. because it's deemed to be playing down. We have one boy coming back from injury in the 18s at the minute, and we said, do you want minimal minutes at the weekend with the 18s, which we can only guarantee you, or there's an under 17s friendly game next week, you could probably play a lot of minutes in that. And he was like, no, 18s. Because it's deemed to be better opposition, better level. But I'm going, you just need to play football and get used to the chaos again. So it really is education and ongoing education about playing up and playing down. And that has to come from the technical staff more than anyone, with the parents, that, listen, this is the reason your boy's not playing. And sometimes that's a hard conversation to have, because when you're not playing, the parents think there's something wrong. It's not always the case. Not always the case.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, I mean, definitely my philosophy of S&C over the years has completely changed, where, you know, you think you're the most important person at the club till you realise you're a very small cog in a much bigger system. And as you say, the most important thing is, you know, to quote Kieran on Flat, the most important thing is to become a PhD in your sport. You know, so if you're a footballer, you need to be a PhD at football. It doesn't matter, you can be the fastest, strongest, biggest, but if you can't play, you're not getting a contract. Same is true of rugby. But ultimately, that comes down to your availability to train, which means time on task and getting that input from people who are experts at coaching and helping you develop, but also those competitive opportunities. So as you kind of alluded to, you know, okay, if we were to maximize your competitive opportunities, you can get maybe 10 minutes in this situation, maybe 40 or, you know, an entire game in this situation. It's interesting that people would choose the one where they're going to get less, because actually you think, well, the opportunity to develop your game understanding, your strategy, your tactical awareness, your positional awareness, it's going to be much more frequent opportunities in that 40 minutes than there is in the 10. But there is that kind of, I guess, paradox where people may choose the higher level of competition because 5 minutes at under 23s is better than 45 at, you know, under 18s.
Yeah, that's always a conversation. I had quite a few boys this week travel for a game with the 23s, and some of them didn't travel. So they see that playing up in every level, by the way. So if you've played up, if you're the best under 12, you play up 13s, and then you're the best under 13s and you play 4. You're always playing up, and there's always that expectation to play up. So I asked in training yesterday, because there was a little bit of moping around, going one or two of the boys who hadn't been selected to travel with their mates, essentially with the boys, they seem to be in their heads, I'm the same level at, if not better. But then they don't understand it. It comes down to position. It comes down to requirement. So I said to them, so would you rather travel and sit on the bench and get back to the club at 3 a.m. having been on a bus for 6 hours? Or would you prefer to be here now and have a 90 minute hard session and a weight session after where you're getting development? And when you ask them that question, and then they have to think about it, they go, okay, that makes sense. Yeah, probably want to be here training. Exactly. So you're trying to get the context. It's all context, Rob. It's always deemed to be, you're playing up, you're the best. You're playing up, that means he rates me. So if the coach asks me to play it down, then that means he doesn't rate me. Or if I haven't played up, I've just stayed at the same level for 2 years. Well, that means you've been, you know, I have one boy at the minute who hasn't played up. But he's played every minute for our under 18s this week. And I said, why do you think that is? Because the coach trusts you. He wants you in the squad. You haven't played up because that position has already been filled by two other people that need minutes. So I think it's, if you're transparent and honest, it's when you don't give them an answer as a parent or a player, as an adult, we know the same. If we're not getting the clear answers, you bring your car in and it's making noise and the guy goes, oh, it's a bit of this. It's going to cost this. No, tell me, what is it? Why is this not continually not working? And you keep bringing it back and you keep getting the same answer. The same thing. Young boy keeps being dropped or keeps playing down or not playing up. If you're not transparent, then that leads to, well, you're not managing expectation then.
Well, I want to be mindful of your time because, you know, we've been at it nearly an hour now. So we'll just start to wrap things up. What's next for you in the next, you know, upcoming 12 to 18 months? You got anything on the horizon, or are you so fixated in the middle of the season you can't think beyond May?
That's a very interesting conversation. I've had, I turned 41 last week. I think I'm having a midlife crisis. I'm only joking now. At the moment, you know, ninth season at Arsenal, coming in with, you know, a new head of department, Tony, who I'm learning lots from, and, you know, seeing how he's guiding things. 9 years in one place is a very long time, I suppose. So, you know, still work closely with Satanta, doing a bit of tutoring. I'm on the board of UKSCA, which I'm really starting to get my my teeth and ideas into to look at how I can bring on the association with the rest of the board members more. So I'm really concentrating on that and trying to better the profession, really. For me personally, I just want to continue enjoying my job, continue developing the players that are working with me, develop new skill sets. That's why I talk to likes yourself, Rob, and different people, is to see what's going on out there. With regards to work, the next step to another role in the club or outside of the club, I'm not sure what that looks like yet. You know, my wife and I are a team here, and you know, her job is, has opportunity to move as well. So we're not really quite sure, honestly, what we're doing. I'm at Arsenal for now, doing the best I can for now. Not sure what plans Tony has for me going forward. I know he's very keen to, for my input there, but you know, everything runs its cycle eventually. So what's the next challenge for me? I'm not quite sure. I definitely have this season in me and see from there. So that's quite, I know that's quite a roundabout way of saying I'm not really sure at the moment. Lots going on in a good, positive way, really positive way. So.
Great. So where can people find out more and follow what you're doing in terms of all the different, you know, things that you, you've got going on that you've just mentioned?
Yeah, well, I'm on Twitter. I don't tend to tweet much of work related content due to, you know, copyright and all that. I don't like to do that. I wouldn't do that. They're, the boys are their own men. I don't want to be sending, you know, pictures and videos of our content on there. I'm not hiding anything. I'm very transparent in my methodology. But I do retweet the odd thing I like and see. And I did recently retweet or tweet that I was going to run some webinars for coaches out there and all the areas we're talking about. So I'm hoping to link in maybe with the UKSCA and Setanta and or a few other people on that to make it a bigger thing than I first expected, because there was a huge demand for it. So I'm on, the Twitter handle is @coach_roach. _ if you want to just drop me a message there, or you can get me on proche@arsenal.co.uk if you have any questions or follow-ups. I try to get back to you ASAP. And yeah, and watch out, I suppose, watch out for upcoming events, both from the UKSCA and myself, in all these areas we just spoke about today.
Well, thanks so much for your time, mate. I know it's really valuable to get an insight into what's happening at one of the leading academies. So thanks for your insight and your honesty.
Thank you for having me on, and to the listeners for listening. And I know we went off in tangents there, but as always, anyone that knows me, I'm trying to be just transparent and honest, and there's no magic. Keep it simple, keep it basic, and keep it progressing.
Don't forget, you can find us on Instagram using the account @LTAD Network, as well as Twitter @LTAD Network, and find our website www.ltadnetwork.com. Thanks for listening to this episode, and don't forget to get your 7-day free trial to our online platform, as well as 50% off your first month with the code LTADVIP50.